right, so we're going to read now from Exodus 17, and we'll read the entire chapter together. Then all the congregation of the sons of Israel journeyed by stages from the wilderness of Sin according to the command of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, "Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand your staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. He named the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarrel of the sons of Israel, and because they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Then Amalek came and fought against Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose men for us and go out, fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And he said, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." In this chapter, Israel faces two different challenges. One challenge is an internal one, and the other is an external one. The main challenge is internal. And what I mean by this is the sin of unbelief that resides in their hearts and would destroy them eternally. The second challenge was more obvious. It was external, and that is the army of Amalek. So we're going to look today at these two challenges, these two threats, the internal and the external. So first, let's consider this internal threat. The Israelites were on the move, traveling toward Mount Sinai, and they came to a place called Rephidim, and there was no water at Rephidim. Now, this sounds familiar. At the end of chapter 15, Israel had a similar challenge. It was, you know, a month or so earlier, so it wasn't that long ago for the Israelites. So we're seeing something of repetition, a repetition of a trial that they had experienced. Why this repetition? Why this repetition? Why do we see a similar trial facing the Israelites now only a month or so later? Well, I think the answer is that because they did so poorly last time and it needed to be repeated. They failed the test. And how did they fail the test? Well, you could say it in several ways, but the way I'm thinking about it today is that they failed to understand what the real problem was. They thought the problem was a lack of water. We're thirsty. We need water to drink. That was the problem in their mind. But that really wasn't the problem that the Israelites had. Their problem was an unbelieving heart. An unbelieving heart. And it reminds me of what the writer of Hebrews says. And in this section of Hebrews, he's actually reflecting upon the children of Israel and their time in the wilderness. But I think it accurately sums up their problem. This is Hebrews 3 and verse 12. He says, "Take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from the living God." That was their problem. An evil, unbelieving heart. They just could not trust God. The lack of water was not a problem at all. If they understood who was with them, but they didn't. They were unbelieving. The lack of water was not the problem. In fact, the lack of water highlighted the problem. And so if we see it in that sense, it is actually part of the cure. The cure of their unbelief. They faced trial after trial, and it had a similar effect of highlighting this problem. Now, for ourselves, we may wonder at times why we face so many trials in our lives. And why sometimes there are similar ones that come up. Sometimes our trials seem to arise on a daily basis. It may be within our home, it may be in the workplace. But sometimes we face repeated trials. We may wonder why. Well, the answer to that's rather simple. God is committed to uncovering our unbelief that still resides in each of our hearts. We should see and learn to see these trials in a different way. These trials are like a scan, you know, that we go, you know, Warren's had one, I'm sure, or two recently. And a scan is meant to reveal things that we can't see with the naked eye. They show up hidden things. And so these trials are like scans. They highlight what we can't see with our eye, the hidden things of the human heart. These trials are to highlight those things that are going on within you. They bring those things out, reveal the problems that are going on in your soul. So, how did the Israelites do this time, second time round? Well, they faced this trial just as they faced the last trial, only worse. They are slow to learn. They blamed Moses. They demanded water. In verse 3, they accuse Moses. They said to Moses, Why now have you brought us up from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? Looks pretty bad. They've faced it in unbelief. But it's even worse than that because of what Moses says in verse 3. At the end of verse 2. He said, why do you quarrel with me? Why do you put the Lord to the test? So why do you test the Lord? And it's repeated in verse 7. The place is called Massah and Meribah. Meribah means quarrel and Massah means to test. Because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? And what does it mean to test the Lord? Well, really what they were doing in testing the Lord, it's a way of sort of putting demands upon God. It's telling God, well, now you have to act. And this is the way you have to act. It's what Jesus avoided doing in Matthew chapter 4, verses 5 to 7. Interestingly, Jesus quotes from Deuteronomy 6:16, and it talks about not putting the Lord to the test as they did at Massah. And that's the very thing that Jesus quoted about not putting the Lord to the test. The devil said to Jesus, throw yourself from the temple so God will have to come to rescue you. He was putting demands upon God, and Jesus refused, you shall not do that. It's ungodly to treat God in that way. We can't push God around. We can't force God's hand. We can't put him to the test. He won't be treated in this way by us. For the simple reason that it's not us who is in charge of God. We can't put pressure on God to act. He is free to act in his time. He's in charge. We submit to his authority. We submit to his timing. We submit to his plans. He doesn't have to dance to our tune. It is wrong to put God to the test. Now, as we read these stories, we may be tempted to shake our head at their unbelief. But again, as we read these stories, that's not the purpose. We've got to ask ourselves, are we any different? How do we face trials? How do you face trials? They might be just minor things, minor annoyances that crop up. How do you face the trials in your life? Don't we distrust God? Don't we turn to despair? Aren't we anxious? Don't we think, how am I going to get through this at times? How am I going to... Sometimes we don't even respond that way. We just respond instantly with frustration and anger. But what we do is just like the Israelites. We miss what God is doing through the trial. We see trial, but we don't see God. God was among these Israelites, but they couldn't see him. He was right there with them. That problem was nothing to him, as he proves by the story. Yet they didn't have eyes to see. Do we have eyes to see the God who is with us and has promised, I'll never leave you nor forsake you? May God grant us the eyes to see when a trial arises, to see God in it. What's God doing through it? What's he doing in my life? How does he want me to face this in faith? Maybe what sin is he highlighting and bringing up to the surface through this trial? God is committed to your growth. He's committed to sending these scans to reveal what's in your heart so that you and I might deal with them. So the Israelites failed this as they did last time. But we see in this story that Moses was different. In verse 4, Moses turns to the Lord. So Moses cried out to the Lord saying, "What shall I do to this people? A little more and they will stone me." The situation was serious and he didn't know what to do. They were getting nasty. He feared that their anger was going to bubble over to the point of picking up stones and hurling them at Moses. So it's a pressure situation. He feels his life is in danger. How did Moses react? He doesn't seem to despair or get angry. He turns to God in prayer. And in that prayer, we see that Moses confesses that he does not have the answers. He doesn't know how to handle this situation. He's not just this amazingly wise leader who just knows what to do in every circumstance. Moses said, "What shall I do to this people? I don't know." But the main thing is, Moses knew where to turn. I think this is a wonderful example of godly leadership. Godly leaders in the church, but also godly leaders in the home or in any other setting. A leader is not one who has all the answers. Boy, I know that of myself. I feel that all the time in the church and in the home. I don't have the answers to everybody's problems. I don't know the best decision to make. But you don't have to be a godly leader. You must know where to turn. To turn to God for help and guidance. And that's what we need. And that's what we need as churches. We need leaders who know where to turn. We need people of prayer who turn to God. I think that's one of the main problems we face in the church. The church is so full of gurus. You know, these supposedly wise people who write books and have all the answers to the church's problems. Here it is, here's my book, just read that and follow that and you'll be right. And boom, your church will grow, you're going to reach the community and there's going to be a revival and just follow this book because I have all the answers. Well, that's nonsense. What we need is leaders who turn to God in prayer. That's a biblical example. Because we don't know. We don't have the answers. Only God does. Well, then lastly, we see in this section that the Lord told Moses what to do. And I've said here in the outline there that God heals. I think something like that, yeah. So, verses 5 and 6. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pass before the people, and take with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I'll stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, and the people that the people may drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So Moses followed God's direction. He didn't worry about the people. He just did what God said. He took the staff. He grabbed some elders who seemed to be the witnesses to this miracle. And he went to this rock at Horeb. Horeb is probably a name for an area where Mount Sinai was. So how close he was to Mount Sinai, we don't know. But it's a particular rock and it's in this region, Horeb. And he did what God said. He struck the rock with the staff. and out came water. And it seems that this was, everything was unusual, but it was an abundant flow of water. In the Psalms, there's several references to this event. I'm just going to turn to one in Psalm 105 and verse 41, which speaks of the abundance of the water that came out. He opened the rock and water flowed out. It ran in the dry places like a river. And some have actually thought that this river sort of somewhat followed the Israelites for a time throughout their travel in the wilderness. That might be the case. There's certain Psalms that might hint at that. But it is an abundant supply, an abundant. It gushed out. It had to be a lot of water, of course, to satisfy the thirst of over 2 million people, as well as the livestock. So it had to be abundant, and God provided for them. But what is particularly astonishing, I think, in this story is the background to it. The background of the people's rebellion and distrust. God says, take the staff, the one that you struck the Nile with. Remember, it was the one that turned the Nile to blood, and it was the symbol of God's power and the instrument that God used to bring about the plagues upon Egypt. And instead of striking the people because of their repeated disobedience and unbelief, God struck the rock and provided for their needs. It's another testimony of God's amazing kindness toward them. And what he was doing through this is really, he was dealing with the problem of their unbelief. He was healing their unbelief because he was showing to them that he was among them and that he was for them. He wasn't against them. He wasn't treating them like he treated the Egyptians. Otherwise, they would have come under his judgment. But instead, abundant provision. He is for his people. And they could look to that and to see. At that time, we were rebellious. At that time, we were unbelieving. What did God do? He provided for us. What a God. What a God who can be trusted. See, he's overcoming their unbelief, the real problem. For us, where do we look? Where do we turn? When we're tempted to doubt, when we're tempted to despair, when we're tempted to ask questions like, is the Lord really among us or not? Well, we go to the cross, don't we? We go to the cross. Because there we see that our God is a God who can be trusted, a God who is for us, a God who is with us. And that will overcome the unbelief that is within our hearts. It is the cross of Christ that God uses to defeat our evil, unbelieving hearts and replace them with a heart of faith. Well, let's turn now to the external threat. The external threat. From verse 8 to 16, this is the first battle Israel faced coming out of Egypt. That this is part of a long history of opposition. This was not the first opposition that they faced. Of course, they just come out from Egypt where they were oppressed. But as we trace the history before, God's people continue to face opposition. The first being Abel, who was put to death by his brother. But it's a long history. It is the lot of God's people to face opposition. Even though God had defeated the main enemy of the Israelites at this time, this opposition rises up from another place. And so also for us, Jesus has defeated the main enemy on the cross. He's defeated Satan. He's defeated sin. He's defeated death. But there is still much opposition we must face. The Amalekites seem to be a semi-nomadic people traveling around in that region. And they were descendants of Esau. They really had no reason to attack the Israelites. Obviously, they felt threatened by their presence. But they were the ones that attacked first. So Moses told Joshua to get an army together to fight against them. It all seems rather straightforward. The enemy is visible. All we have to do is to get some people together and fight against this enemy. And yet even here there were dangers and things that they had to learn about fighting, about warfare. And there are really two things that I want to draw out from our passage today that are abiding lessons. Things they had to learn, things we must know also. Well, the first thing is that they must fight in God's power, not their own. Really, it is a strange story when we take in all the details. You know, it's straightforward. Joshua, gather some troops, go out and fight against these guys. But Moses went up a hill, not to direct the army, not to simply, sit down and watch the events. But he was told that he had to hold up the staff of God in his hand. And as he was holding up this staff, the Israelites were winning. But when he dropped the staff or lowered it, the Amalekites were winning. And we read in our story that Moses' hands were heavy, or he was getting tired. He couldn't continue to hold up this staff. And so he needed help. Verse 12, they took a stone, they put it under him, and they sat upon it. He sat upon it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other, so that staff would continue to be raised. That's odd. But the lesson, hopefully, is clear. Israel's victory was dependent on the Lord's power, symbolized by the staff. When that staff was raised up, they would win. When it was down, they would lose. Some have also seen a connection here with prayer, which I think is not directly, but I think it's a valid implication. Israel had to fight this one. They had to amass troops. They had to go out into the battlefield. They had to risk their lives, but they had to do so in dependence upon the Lord's power. That's what this story is about. Fighting, but fighting in dependence upon the living God. And this principle, my friends, is just as relevant for us Christians. There is a war going on. There is a war going on, but it is unseen. It is unseen. I think really that's what the book of Revelation is about. You know, it's revealing or uncovering the hidden battle. It was God sort of, taking the covering off so that John is able to see what is really going on, what this battle is, where it's raging. We've got to understand as believers that this war is going on today, but it is largely unseen. It's the war between God's kingdom and the kingdom of Satan, or the kingdom of this world that's in rebellion against God. And if you're a Christian today, you're involved. You're in this war. You can't opt out. You're in it. You're involved. But there is only one way to fight in this war, and that is in dependence upon the living God. We read from Ephesians chapter 6 earlier on, and verse 10 says this: finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. It's the same message, isn't it? Fight, we must. But how? In dependence upon God, using His power. We have no power really of our own. Our war is against, as is commonly said, the world, the flesh, and the devil. And we would fall every time if we relied on our own wisdom and strength. And that is perhaps why we do fall at times. Because we're relying upon ourselves. We go out into the world day by day without being clothed with the armor of God. We go out into the world without praying and crying out to God. We enter situations, we enter trials or opposition without calling upon the name of God. And we wonder why we're defeated. We wonder why we fail. We sin. We offend God. We don't further the cause of Christ. We actually damage, do harm to the cause of Christ. My friends, our spiritual enemies are too powerful and too crafty. It's only by God's power that we can stand. Listen to what Paul says. Again in Ephesians 6, verse 11 to 13. Put on the full armor of God, so that you will be able to stand firm against the schemes of the devil. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. There's a heavenly battle or a spiritual battle going on. Verse 13, therefore, take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist in the evil day. And having done everything, to stand firm. Brothers and sisters, you must understand this. We are at war. Every day you live, you are at war. You don't have a choice. And Satan and his army have you in their sights. You must be prepared. And the way to be prepared is to draw upon God's power as well as His provision. And that's why prayer is so vital to this battle. Paul ends by saying, with all prayer and petition, pray at all times in the Spirit. And with this in view, be on the alert with all perseverance and petition for all the saints. And pray for me also, he asks. Prayer. What are we lacking today in the church? prayer. Why are we being defeated? My friends, call upon God. As Paul says, pray at all times in the Spirit. Call upon God. Every day you're going out into battle, even this day, you're going into battle to some degree as you come to church. Sometimes it is a battle to come to church. It's a battle to get there. Things happen. Call upon God that He would supply you abundantly with His power. But also, people of God, as a church, we need you to pray more than anything. That's the most important way you can contribute to this church. Yes, your attendance is good. It's wonderful. But we need your prayer. And we need you to unite in prayer. Not just pray individually. We've got to fight as an army. We've got to fight together, don't we? Standing together, calling upon God together. So that's the first thing, the first principle. Fight in God's power. But then the second principle. The battle is the Lord's. The battle is the Lord's. And I'm taking this from the final verses there, 14 to 16. It was vital for Israel to understand something about this warfare. And it was that it wasn't their war, ultimately. It was not personal. But it was at God's command. God commanded, they had to obey. It was the Lord who was against Amalek. It was His war. And He promised to continue this war until it was complete. Notice what it says. Verse 14, God says, I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek. Verse 16, the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation. So Moses was to write it in a book so that they would remember. Then Moses built an altar and called it, the Lord is my banner. Or perhaps the Lord is my standard or rallying point. It's a flag with a symbol on it that was to draw God's people together to fight. So he's saying that the people of God must rally around God. We must unite under His banner. David was one that understood this in his battle against Goliath. He said to Goliath, you come to me with swords and spears. I come to you in the name of the living God, the God of the armies of Israel. And he says in that passage, 1 Samuel 17, that it is the Lord's battle. God's fighting in this one. That's why David had confidence to go forward. It's the Lord's battle. And for us, we must be sure that the fights that we get involved in are His and for the advance of His kingdom. There's another story of David in 1 Samuel 25 where he's warned by Abigail, Nabal's wife, not to come against Nabal because that wasn't the Lord's battle. That was David's battle. He was going there to wipe out Nabal and the males in the household. Abigail warns him humbly and subtly, but says, you're the one that fights the Lord's battles, not these ones. So David pulled back. They're the battles we need to be engaged in, the Lord's battles. We fight against sin and against error. We fight for the truth of the Word of God. We fight for the purity and unity of the church. We fight for souls. And we fight His way. That's what it means to remember that this is the Lord's battle. I think one of Satan's tactics he uses is to distract us. It's to get us fighting the wrong battle. And when we look around, that can be seen. We're all fighting these little battles in our life, all fighting on our own. So distracted, not united, fighting the Lord's battles at all, fighting our own personal battles. While Satan's kingdom is left intact. We might be fighting a person at work. Unfortunately, we can be fighting at times another person in the church. Or maybe our fights are centered in the home. Unfortunately, these are all too common. Maybe we're fighting for our rights as citizens. That's become very common among Christians. But my question is, are these the Lord's battles? Are they the Lord's battles? Are you confident that they're His? Are they really for His kingdom? Are we fighting for Him, or are we just fighting for ourselves and our own personal wants? When we fight, brothers and sisters, we must be sure we are uniting together in the battles that He's called us to join in. Only then can we be assured of His power. Of course, it's not always easy to know. Is this a battle that God wants me to join in? Is this really what He is doing at this moment? There are some questions we can ask to help us and guide us in discerning. Is this the Lord's battle? Questions like these. Has He commanded it? Is it for His glory? Is it for the benefit and unity of the church? Is it for the eternal well-being of souls? Is this really about the kingdom of Christ? Or is it really just about my own little kingdom? To have life the way I want it to. I want it to be. These are the questions we must ask. It's time to fight. It's time to fight. The war goes on. May we fight as a congregation in God's power. And may we united stand together and fight the Lord's battles. Amen.